Hey there, welcome to Sauce Unbound. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at Sauce Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Antoine, founder and CEO of Fernand, and a customer support platform designed specifically for sauce companies, and also the founder of ImprovMX, a closed source free email forwarding service that he recently sold, and we did a podcast with Matthew, the acquirer. So you have to check it out. But super happy to see you here.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Sure, first time, anytime.
Second time around already.
Yes.
I love coming back.
Right? It's been 2 years. And I remember that even then, you were kind of toying with the idea of selling one of the companies. And yeah, it was interesting that, you know, you were trying to already then kind of see who would your perfect acquirer could be. So yeah, maybe let's start there. Like, what is ImprovMX in the first place? And why that? Like, of the two businesses, why did you decide to sell this one and focus on Fernand?
Mm-hmm. So ImprovMX is a service we bought about 7 years ago from an indie developer in Georgia, the country, not the state, where he created a little tool for himself to forward emails from a custom domain to his personal email address. And it was a big success in the developers community, you know, things like Hacker News, Reddit, etc. And it grew like organically up to the point where this original founder found that it was too much work for him. It was also completely free and unmonetized. So we reached out to him and we kind of got a good deal, I think. I think we bought it for less than $5,000 at the time. But we had to rebuild everything. So we've rebuilt the product from the ground up. We've added subscription types, a bit of friction, and also a lot of premium features that people would want to pay for. So like webhook redirection, you send an email and you get basically an API call out of it. Things like integrations, things like much faster email forwarding and like security hosting, compliance, etc. So we tried to make a real product, almost a real company out of it. And it grew really well. I think we ended around 30K MRR at the point where we sold it. And why we sold it is because we have another product on the side. My co-founder Cyril and I were really builders at core and not really operators. And ImprovMX was starting to be an infrastructure company. We were sending 2 million email daily. So it meant a lot of servers, a lot of things that can potentially break, a lot of like 3 a.m. on a Sunday pager call to get something back online. And we felt that we were just scrambling with all of those operations. We didn't really have any experience of how those things work at a bigger company. And it felt like the product would benefit from a more established kind of structure of someone or a team that could take it to really like the next level. I know it sounds super cliche and everybody says this, but I think for us, it was really, really true where we felt like, has this outgrown us? Like, we're not really good at managing people, recruiting, all of this. We were doing this because we had to, but we were having so much more fun building our other product, Fernand, which is this customer support help desk for SaaS, which is a product where I think we can be just my co-founder and I for as long as, I don't know, like at least a few millions in ARR. And without the need of being so relying on building a team and setting up processes, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But how did you approach it then? Like, all right, so you started thinking about selling. Did you go through kind of, okay, the easy road, Flippa, Empire Flippers, Quiet Light, or you started reaching out to people that you know and kind of going from your network?
Yeah. So we've already had an exit before with a tool called Voila Norbert, which is like a way to find contact information for cold emailing and stuff like this. A bit similar to Apollo now, Lemlist, etc. And so through this, we already had a few contacts from the people that, you know, I've reached out to through this previous acquisition. And we just sent a couple emails here and there. And then I realized, maybe I could expand that network. I found a list, I believe, on Laura Roda. I probably pronounce her name wrong, but she built a tool called Edgar. I'll meet Edgar.
Yeah. She sold it to SureSwift a few years back. Yeah.
That's right. And so she has this blog post where she say how I cold emailed my way into, I don't know, 7-8-figure exit. And she lists like a lot of the typical acquirers of SaaS businesses. So of course, SaaS Group is one of them. You have SureSwift, you have Tiny, you have et cetera, et cetera. And I think there was also a list of brokers down there. And I thought, you know, let me just send a quick email to all of those. And we got a lot of replies. But obviously what those bigger company wants is a lot bigger products. So at 30K MR, it meant we were at, what, 350,000 in ARR. And I think most of them want at least $1 million ARR to start kind of like thinking about acquiring you. So we've had some discussions and it was always like, hey, great, come back to us when you're bigger. Although two of them were really interested and we went up to like an offer kind of thing. I think at this point, I was not really happy with the valuation that they were giving us. And it probably also come from the fact that I reached out as a cold email kind of thing. You don't have that much leverage because it really feels like you are actively trying to sell very quickly. Or yeah, it's really like you're coming with your offer. And so when they start giving you back a valuation, they have all the cards in hand, I think. So this didn't work out because we just couldn't agree on a price. And then I thought, maybe let's look at the broker route again so that at least it's not me, the founder, who goes like kind of using the word begging for selling, but it's at least someone more neutral that will go and pitch for you and be like, look at this great opportunity. And they have also another kind of extended network of people. And it's at that time that I've had the contact from a broker called John Heinemann at QuietLight, which surprisingly also sold this previous company to the same people that acquired Norbert. So we had this in common and we were kind of exchanging on this. And over a few months, he was like, you know, if you want, we could list ImproveMX for you on QuietLight and let's see how it goes. And it really took like a lot of time from my first cold emails to the like actually going with QuietLight probably took a year and a half. Just because we, you know, we kept growing. The pain of like wanting to exit was not that huge. But when we started to see more and more traction on Fernand, it was clear that we just cannot like keep operating two products bootstrapped with a job on the side, two kids, and like a lot of other personal commitments. So it was clear that we needed to sell either one of them, and Fernand is still relatively small, so it made just no sense to sell it. Plus, it's the bet that we like. Like, it's the most shiny object for us to be working on. So that's why we listed ImproveMX with that broker, QuietLight, and then went from there.
Okay. That's great. Well, you were talking about, you know, how the other two offers didn't go through because of the valuation misunderstanding. And I'm wondering, how did you, like, what did you base your valuation, expected valuation on?
Yeah, so I think for us, it was clear that we wanted the typical thing. I think it was, you know, the 3-5x ARR or something. We were pretty reasonable with this, but we had clear other demands, as in we wanted to both exit the business, because if we don't exit it pretty cleanly, then it doesn't satisfy the need of selling for focusing on Fernand of other products. So this was kind of non-negotiable. We also very much preferred all cash versus all these crazy deals that sometimes PE, VCs and others come up with. So, you know, where you get like 50% cash and then over 4 years, you vest based on the company's performance and stuff like this. And so, yeah, preferred very much an all cash option. I think it's anyway much cleaner. And we were also looking at someone that would operate the company not in a, I don't know what to say, too salesy, too marketing-y, you know, like going to change all of the cool stuff that we've built, annoy the users and potentially damage the brand. So someone that could really understand what we've built till now and continue on that legacy and also have the shoulders to handle all this technical stuff, because it's a very, or it was a very technical product.
Okay. You found Matthew. So you were selling to another person. It's not a PE. It's not a, you know, group like SaaS group. And yeah, I wonder what kind of due diligence was even possible on your buyer.
Yeah. So through Quiet Light, we went through this whole process of, I guess, writing a prospectus, like, you know, like all the numbers are pre-collected by the broker so that they put together a package of like a nice advertisement for you. And then they put it out to their buyers and directly, like literally the same day, we already had two calls line up with potential buyers and then a few others in the next days. But really, like, it showed that there were some people that really flashed like at a really big wish to discuss or try to snatch it from others. And Matthew was one of them. What we really like with Matthew compared to the other that we talked with was that directly when we had that first call, it felt like, oh, he could have joined the team right now. Like, he's a little bit like us. I think he's made money through other channels by, you know, I think crypto trading and so investments, financially, etc. So he was just looking at how can he put that money to work by acquiring a SaaS and almost like buying himself a job, if that makes sense, which is very funny because one of the previous VC that I've called email and we were talking was telling me the exact opposite. It's like, I don't want to buy myself a job, which is why the valuation should be smaller because I will hire people and I need to have this working capital and etc. And then I have that person in a call telling me, not directly, but like basically, hey, I have experience as a site reliability engineer at Google and stuff, and this is really right up my alley. I think I could do a lot of it without hiring a ton of people. And it felt like, that's a good fit because he can value it. He also understands it and he can operate it. So it was like, ding, 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 green mark, green mark, green mark. And then, of course, from our side, the due diligence from the buyer was really more like, you know, Googling him, trying to find out what he thinks about like some previous experiences, which was a little bit harder for this case because he's not really been building anything in the past. It's just like kind of new to that whole, I guess, community. But one thing I found funny is that he was talking about a few podcasts and quoting like a few things on his Twitter account that I'm like, oh, I listen to that too. So he's just talking about the same people that I like to listen to. And it felt like, again, like a bit of reassurance that this was the right thing. And at the end of the day, compared to those like bigger PE firms and VCs and stuff, it just felt like right, like we could trust him. And yeah, like just the better fit, kind of a gut feeling.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Like, just, you know, the fact that I already interviewed him and just listening to you now, it's such a, like, that all the pieces of the puzzle just kind of come together because that's what he said exactly. Like, I wanted to work on something. I wanted something fairly challenging on the engineering side. And, like, I don't want to change much because it's a great product. And kind of, you know, it almost felt like the mindset that we have at SaaS Group just on a smaller scale, which is also really funny for me to realize. But yeah, it really, like with you two, it does look like a great fit. So he was ready to kind of entertain everything you just said, kind of your vision of a dream exit. And what did you end up with? Like, with the whole deal structure and also the post-acquisition? Because even if it's a cash out, there is still a transition period. So yeah. How did it feel after, you know, the money exchange hands, basically?
There was a lot. I think we're jumping a lot of steps with until we get there. But one thing that happened when we negotiated is maybe more of an anecdote, but like, you know, when you go with a broker, you get a lot of offers directly, like literally on that day, or a lot of not really formalized offer, but hey, we're interested, like interest. And Matthew did something, I think, incredibly smart. He raised his initial offer. I think he made an offer like literally the same day after the call at price. So we listed for a certain amount, and then he just matched that all cash with 30-day closing or something. It was like, okay, yes, that's what we wanted. Let's just, like, you cannot even say no. This is great. But of course, we also have all of the other interesting people lined up for a call on, I don't know, that Tuesday, then Friday, whatever. And what he did, which I think was incredible, he just came back at the end of that weekend, so literally a day after or something, and he said, well, you know what? I'm upping my offer up to, I don't know, a few hundred Ks. And we're like, yes, let's do it, because there is just no reason not to entertain the hope of even like having those other calls. And we just thought it was so transparent and nice that we were like, okay, I think we see what you're doing here. We like you too. Let's just do it. So that was one interesting, funny thing that I don't think happened in a ton of cases. And then in terms of support, everything was discussed through all these lawyers and all of this like long due diligence process from the buyer side. We landed on, I think it was 3 months support post-close. But honestly, we've done very little. So I think it was just a way for Matthew to protect himself in case like anything breaks or anything. But he really didn't use that time that much. We were just there on the Slack channel ready to jump if anything needs our attention. Just to give you an idea, I think I've worked less than 5 hours over the next 3 months on this. We did work a lot during the transition period. So like putting a data room together with all of the standard of operations, all of the accounts that we have, or everything works in the infra. Like, I think there I spent probably 100 hours just like formalizing everything. And also during the transition period, we figured out that our company was established in France, but he wanted to like create a new entity in the US, which makes a ton of sense. And I think it's pretty common. The main difficulty with this was twofold. One, you have a lot of requirements in terms of data privacy and stuff when you transfer European user data to the US. And second, you cannot just transfer a Stripe account to the US or like to another country. So what you need to do is to transfer users. There is a whole like migration thing that needs to happen. And it's like basically going over to a new Stripe account in the US with the chance of like, you can actually destroy everything and kill your business. So this was a really stressful, like crazy migration. We've done like custom scripts and stuff to just go and check everything a couple of times. But at some point we needed to press the button and start migrating. I think we had hundreds of thousands of free users and definitely 20K paying users or something that needed to be transferred onto Stripe. This was like,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because like, yeah, it's a European company and Matthew's in New York. And I was wondering, like, even on the legal side, like, how did it work? Was there anything like surprising? How did, you know, because that's what he said as well, like over this month, like if it wasn't for the lawyers just going over everything, yep, you guys could have closed in like 2 weeks. But because it's a much more difficult process, because you're also in different countries, that took much longer. Was there anything like super surprising in on the way?
It was always like new stuff piling onto new stuff. So like our lawyers were, it was a difficult challenge because it was all happening over Christmas and New Year's period. And find a law firm in France that is willing to work over the holiday break. This was already one very fun thing. Well, we found a great one actually. They're called Bold Lawyers, and they're a bit taking the productized service route. So, not the traditional lawyer firm where you get billed by the hour and you never know how much hours they're gonna put in. So it's just like, okay, bill us at the end. Well, please not so much. What they come up with is like a fixed price and everything is included. And it's also pretty much SaaS friendly or startup friendly, so they know exactly how SaaS or startup works and all the legal framework around this. They do a lot of equity raises with abroad, like outside investors and stuff. So it was really good to be able to talk with a law firm that actually understood our use case and that was a little bit more modernized. But of course, the whole document that our buyer sent was based on, I believe, US law. And our lawyers are not specialized in US law. They're in French law. And actually, they kind of mandated that because our company, what we sell, the asset of the company, is in France, then it needs to take like all of those French law components. And so this is basically was like this arguing between like, no, this needs to be like this. This needs to be like this. Matthew was great, actually. I think he gave a lot away in that process. And it's amazing because I don't think we could have worked around a ton of this. Like the law is the law, right? Like if your lawyers tell you that it has to be a certain way, there are some things you just cannot change. But in the end, I think it worked out pretty well.
All right. Tell me a little bit more about Data Room, because this is again something that we get a lot of questions about. And I believe you also asked like when you were only thinking about potentially selling, that was one of the questions that you raised. Like, what is a data room? Like, what is supposed to be there? So what was in yours? And again, what was maybe surprising or difficult to arrange?
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Yeah, maybe we should open source a template or something. Because I think when I looked into this, I could only find data rooms for like, those bigger, like crazy companies like that have factories and stuff. And it definitely didn't apply to us with a small bootstrap SaaS. This took a lot of time and effort. We just used Notion to organize all of the document and everything. And you might think of like, yeah, it's just about, sharing all of the accounts that you use and their passwords and stuff. But like, how do you actually go and do this? Is really more complex than it seems. So this was actually the easy part. The legal aspect we needed to find was that for each service we registered to, let's say Amazon Web Services, you need to contact their sales team and legal team to make sure that you can transfer the account to someone else. And like basically every service online, most services have this clause in their terms of services that it's okay to transfer it to someone else, but you need the explicit like consent of the service before. So this took a lot of time tracking. And then, of course, we needed to build kind of an operating manual for Matthew to take over the company, because like, where does everything live? What's the infra like? What can you do when something happens here? Like, how do you troubleshoot this? What kind of brand voice do we have? Like, where does design live, etc.? And so this, I kind of kicked myself, because when I was writing it, I thought, God, why did we never invest the time to write this before for ourselves? Like, I felt like, you know, when, I don't know if this is the case where you live, but like in Germany, when you leave a flat you're living in, you have to paint the walls all again, like perfectly white, this kind of a thing. And last time I did that in the flat we left, it felt like, why didn't we paint this before? It looks amazing now. And it's a little bit the same feeling that I had with ImproveMX. We're like, oh, we could have done much more, like onboarding our employees with this Notion document. They would have been like 10x better employees start from the first day. What we did at the time was just like, hey, here are your assignment. Like, this is what we expect from you. You'll have a lot of autonomy. Go and figure it out. But imagine if they had this crazy, super documented processes for everything. They would have been set up for success much more. So yeah, that's definitely a learning that I have.
Yeah, so start early, right? Even if you're not thinking about selling right now,
yeah,
start prepping, if ever.
Yeah, even if you're not selling at all, I think, you know, the bootstrap founders, they just like run after the shiny things all the time. It's like more features, more like crazy cool marketing things. But sometimes the boring, typical like business school writing some SOPs and stuff, like it's not a bad idea, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Take the best, only the best from the corporates.
Yeah. Exactly.
And do the fun things. All right. Because I want to also talk to you a little bit about Fernand, I would just love to ask you, you know, what is maybe the biggest learning? What would you recommend other SaaS founders looking for an exit to do to make it successful?
Yeah. So I think it's all about trust. Like, this is what I've learned. There was so many moments where our buyer could have said like, no, what is this? This is super weird. I'm walking out. Or try to, you know, renegotiate the deal and be like, no, I'm not paying this price anymore because I've learned about this thing. I don't think in our deal there were any like huge red flag that suddenly popped up, but you can always deal with such people that they will try to squeeze 10K, 50K out of a deal. For us, it was so refreshing to have made the choice from, you know, our gut feeling that this person is actually trustworthy and has really good ethics in general. I think I could be friends with Matthew if I lived there in New York. And that's probably not a requirement. You don't need to feel like you can be friends with your buyer, but like at least some sense of this person will do the right thing if, for example, we give them the wrong access through this crazy thing. Like, we had to handle password management for so many things. And at some point, either we had too much leverage or he had too much. But it was also not a case for like, ha ha ha, I can get this company for free now and like kill everyone. So this was the biggest learning for me. If we ever sell again, I would really make sure that this like gut check is okay. And bit of an anecdote, but on Fernand, we have some customers that are really hard to deal with. And like, I've learned not to work with assholes anymore. I think this is like a big learning. So yeah, that's what I would take away from this deal. Just like,
cool.
Knowing your trust.
I think that's an important one. And just, you know, having met you and Matthew, I think you could be friends. Yeah. He's really cool. All right. Well, I want to talk to you about Fernand, because, you know, now you have all the focus there. Well,
yep.
Maybe not all your focus there is still two kids and a job.
True.
But
true.
Yeah, what are you doing with it? You know, what's the plan, and you know, what is it exactly that you're focusing on?
Yeah, so we really laser focus on being the go-to SaaS solution. I mean, it's a SaaS solution, but for SaaS, so the help desk for SaaS businesses, and even more, more focus would be B2B SaaS. This is the world that I know, that I breeze B2B. I don't know why. Don't ask me why. I know it can be a bit weird, but it's just what I love. And I think I understand the type of problems that people have. And this is what we really are focusing on building. So last week, we've released the ability to train all of the AI components inside Fernand. So it's not only responding or generating text and replies to your customers for you based on the LLM response, but also based on like content and context that you provide. For example, your website, any kind of documents you can upload, but also things that are directly embedded in Fernand. So your knowledge base articles, past replies, etc. You can decide to sync this. And so it means that what we call a smart reply feature, which lets you generate a response to a thread with one single prompt. Let's say you get a invitation to speak at a podcast and you can just type the prompt accept or decline and we'll draft like that. Very nice. Hey, Hannah, blah, 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 blah. One thing that we really are proud of is that we have this philosophy that AI should assist you and not replace you. It should augment. And so you can always like make adjustments to anything. Nothing gets ever sent to your users like before. You have the chance to look at it. So it just gets you faster there. We also did release, though, a first kind of AI agent for our chat widget. So same thing, it gets all the knowledge from this AI training corpus thing that you can feed. And then it will do a first pass at when people ask you something on your widget. So for example, do you have an API? That's a very simple question that you can answer. Or how do you do X with your API? Usually, you know, it's somewhere in the docs buried there and the customer hasn't found the way to get to that info. We can self-serve that now really easily. But again, here you have a big button, talk to a human. So you can always escape and like say, no, I don't want to talk to this boring AI that just doesn't get what I want. And I will be able to talk to the people behind it. So yeah. It's really this philosophy that we are trying to bring. And now the biggest, let's say, project that we have to tackle is our marketing. So Anna, you have to help with this, but
yes.
Anything okay. Gross really in marketing, because the product, like the landing page that we still have, is the landing page with a few tweaks from when we've launched. And the product has evolved so much that we need a whole new like marketing website strategy, etc., to reflect how cool it is, because people just don't know. And so that's definitely on me. I've been procrastinating on this because you know how it is. Like you have your existing customer and you want to support them. And so we haven't spent so much time on acquiring more customers and more like keeping our existing customers very happy. I think retention, we're really, really cool. Like, I think it's the business we've built with the best retention. Although to be fair, there is also a lot of lock-in effect. Like you have all your data, you have put your DNS settings to point to us, etc. So that helps us. But yeah, right now, like for the next 6 months, I think the focus would be less on more features and more on like educating people, like this is what we do, this is our pricing, everything is amazing, you should use it.
And I think that's really smart. But also, you know, just because you started talking about AI, and I just had a conversation like half an hour before this recording with the founder who told me, you know, this is something that keeps him up at night because, well, and I think Fernanda's the same. It was born out of your own problem and you wanted to build something for yourself. So yeah. SaaS and like micro SaaS, let's say, always had this kind of an opportunity to find a niche and find something where, you know, big companies either don't really excel or don't really think it's a big enough problem for them to build something. And now with AI, because it's getting so much easier, when you have your big player tool or whatever not quite working the way you want it, you are able to kind of build a little bit on top of it, make sure that you kind of cover that part that doesn't really work. And you don't really need to look for a micro SaaS anymore. You don't have to look for an additional product. So you can kind of have it all in this bigger setup. So I'm thinking, like, how do you guys think about it? How do you maybe rethink the way you build Fernand? And how do you, like you said, you integrate AI in order to support what's there, kind of core functionality, core values. But is there, like, what do you think? Is, you know, SaaS the way we know it? Is it under, you know, any danger, under any pressure? How do you have to adapt to make sure that it's still relevant?
Let's see. I think we are already seeing a lot of this. So for Fernand, I've built an internal tool in, I don't know, 3 hours with Cursor, just by prompting my way, like, what, vibe coding, right? And I'm not even a developer. I mean, I do front-end development, but, like, I would never have been able to do anything like this. Similarly, when we build features, I'm able to do a lot more than I was able to before. And I was relying on my co-founder to write more like the back-end, like, logic with the front-end. Now I'm able to do a lot more myself. So there is that piece where it's still at the stage of right now empowering the creators to go at it faster and better and hopefully with less bugs and more edge case handling. But I also see a world where you'll be able to prompt an AI to build you a tool exactly for your needs, kind of a one-shot thing. And then it would just host it somewhere and you have it, right? And so I'm pretty sure the first ones to go will be the crazy enterprise tools that businesses don't want to pay for. Like, imagine something like a, I don't know if you're familiar with Workday. It's like managing all of the HR pieces in bigger companies. So request your holidays, your compensation schedule and stuff. The UX is terrible. I'm pretty sure they have a ton of, like, compliance and stuff like that makes it really nice. But I'm also pretty sure it costs, like, a lot every billing cycle. And so imagine a bigger company that have a few engineers in their core teams. What would prevent them from, like, having a dedicated internal tooling team that just go and build those things exactly for the needs they have? And if the needs change, they could just kind of vibe code the next thing. I think it's a very likely future.
Interesting.
Is it now? Is it in 10 years? I don't know.
To be honest, I thought, you know, it's the other way around, because, like, all the big enterprises, like, they're just way too slow. Like, how much time do you need to convince that the guys at the IT department can actually, like, okay, just vibe code whatever you guys need? And you were stupid paying, like, $300,000 per year for whatever you were paying for. And I think it's just, like, that process that needs to change before, because the opportunity is there. You can do it probably now. Mm-hmm. I think for bigger enterprises, it's just a mindset shift that is going to take a little longer. But maybe for, you know, for smaller teams, it could make sense to just, you know, vibe code whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see both ways. But, like, I'm also talking with my experiencing things at Yelp, which is, like, you know, a publicly traded company. Like, when you look at some of the software we use there, and, you know, you pay, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars every year, like, what is the rationale for renewing those contracts when it just solves, like, a tiny piece of your thing that you could actually replace internally in 2 weeks of bench time? before it was just impossible to do that. Like, it's not your core product. Like, we would never invest in this. It would be better to just throw money at the problem. But I'm pretty sure a lot of those, like, old school enterprise-y products, yeah, like the one I mentioned, Workday. I guess another that comes to mind is for expensing called Concur. I think it belongs to SAP. Terrible products. Do the one thing they're supposed to do it kind of wrong. I think they just like integrate really well with finance software and stuff. But I could see how those are more in danger from losing those $1 million a year contracts directly. But then, of course, you're right. Like, I could imagine a world where the microsas to, I don't know, collect testimonials or like book a calendar appointment would go away. For Fernand specifically, I think it would be a little harder because we have so many different products. So when you think about it, it's an inbox, a shared inbox. It's a knowledge base kind of Notion-like product and also has a chat widget with AI embeddings and stuff like this. And so it's more of a product suite than just a tiny fix. If you think about ImproveMX, which we discussed before, the moat is really in the infrastructure, like getting your emails delivered at scale. So I also don't think this is something that would be really under a lot of AI threat. But yeah, definitely some product will be. And I think we should be preparing for this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What about, like, because you're a designer, from a design and UX point of view, how do you think the SaaS products will be changing since, you know, now everything is kind of chat based?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this is the worst take on what AI can do. So every team right now is scrambling to add chatbot-like interfaces to their product, like a Sidekick or something. In some cases, and I think in less than like 5% of the cases, it makes sense. What I'm a huge believer in is having AI help your backend. So for example, you go through a setup flow and you have everything that is kind of predefined with sensible defaults for you. We've understood your use case completely from the start just by scraping your website. And it's kind of a magical experience as if the whole software were built for you. But like signing up through a chatbot is actually a terrible experience. Like, I don't know, just to take that thing. I was trying to do something with Gemini, the product from Google, with Google Sheets. And I was just like, write me a formula to do this. And he just couldn't like do it. I ended up prompting it like 20 times. And it was like, yeah, I see what you want. It's this, right? I'm like, no, count this way and then subtract this. And I think it would have been just faster if I would have done it myself. Like, yeah, I'm not a believer that LLMs are, or at least the conversational side of the UI will be the bigger unlock that everybody think of. And people are also fine to use ChatGPT, Claude or whatever in another tab, copy and paste and go back to do their thing, because this is the model they love and they know how it works. Plus it has memory as well, so it remembers references. Yeah, I think this is more likely, the more likeliest scenario for me, or the one that I would like to see happen.
Yeah. All right, cool. So thanks so much for telling me the story. I think super helpful, but you know, the last two questions are always the same. You've been through this. So what so far, maybe let's take Fernand, right? Because you're working on it mostly right now. What has been this year the biggest win, the biggest failure?
So there is this conference in Hamburg that happens every year called OMR. I mean, you know about this because you came a couple of times. And I always had this idea that I should try some guerrilla marketing campaign around it. And I couldn't find quite like a fun concept that was good enough and not costing $100K or something. You know, Feno is all about calm, delivering calm support, helping you get to inbox zero more in a more focused way. And so I thought, oh, it would be super cool if we'd have a booth with like massages and palm trees and sand where you can really relax in the middle of the conference. But of course, this cost a lot of money. So then I thought, huh, what if, you know, our whole brand is a postman? It actually, my grandfather, who was also a postman, and we thought it was a funny thing because it's really a family business and we're about delivering messages, like letters. And I thought, let's take this brand to the max and I will dress as a postman from France from the 60s and I will write a letter and deliver the letter in envelopes to people. And so I bought this costume on a secondhand shop in France, like a leather bag, a hat. Actually, I think, yeah, I have the hat still on my office because of I have no idea what to do with this anymore. So it's an actual legit hat from the post in the 1960s. And I actually went and did it. And that day when I went out of the car with all this crazy letter, it was super heavy. And everybody looked at me. I was like, is this stupid? Is this an actual really stupid thing? And it took a couple of minutes when I sat down like at the entrance of the thing, speaking French to people like, bonjour, madame, une lettre pour vous, where I really started to feel like, fuck it, like, let's see. But it was a really hard, like, I had to push myself in the day leading up to it, not to be like, ah, maybe I should not do this. It's super weird. Like, all of my body wanted to just cancel it. But I kind of committed to do this for myself. And plus, I printed a lot of stuff. I bought all this equipment. So I thought, okay, go ahead and do this. And I think the lesson is, you can do things that don't scale, that make you completely insecure, unsafe, weird. And usually it would work because you do something else. Like go ahead from what the crowd is doing. Like, for example, if I would start yet another podcast on SaaS businesses, what is it that I would really bring, right? Like you are doing this really well. A lot of other people do that too. Like, if we try to do SEO for Fernand, great, but it's such a saturated market. There's virtually no chance to show up on page one for a lot of the queries. That makes sense. Like, what if we try something completely different? And I think this is what I've learned from that little experiment dressing up.
Yeah.
And what was the other question? I know there was two parts.
So that's a win, right? I think,
yeah.
And you know, I want to support you. Like when I saw it on LinkedIn, I thought it was so smart because, well, I'm a big believer in branding, and you know, I think doing something that sets you apart from others is amazing. Like it can be weird, it can be uncomfortable, but people remember. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, going all in on branding is a great strategy. So yeah, when I saw your post, your video on LinkedIn, I was like, oh man, that's so much fun. Like, and I think we had a conversation about this with Christian Bizza, one of co-founders of OMR. And well, you know, co-founder of OMR, but he still said, you know, big conferences are great, but what's even better is setting yourself up at the entrance or like, you know, at a location super close and just trying to differentiate and like get people are already there. Right. So they're hanging out. So you have an opportunity to get their attention. And I thought, wow, that's super interesting to get from somebody from OMR, but that's exactly what you were doing. But a question from a marketer, did you get any results from it?
Yeah, I think the results were funnily more about telling the story than actually doing the thing. So from the people that I ended this letter, we got a lot of website visits, but almost no sign up, I think under 10. But actually telling that story on Twitter, on LinkedIn, etc., I got like more views than people actually attended the conference. So I think it ended around like in total 100 1,000 views, and I think 60,000 go to that conference. So it's like I reach almost double of the actual people going there. And yeah, I didn't really expect this, but it's true, right? Like there is only so few people going to that one place, but then the entire internet can hear about that story. So
yeah,
but bit of a learning from me as well. Like the whole thing was really more happening afterwards than like in terms of ROI at least.
Yeah.
Cool. And people still talk to me about it now. Like I was attending a design meetup recently, and like a lot of people were like, oh, I saw your post. Oh, so funny. And yeah, people just remember this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Any failures?
Yeah, I think that like what I told you, the marketing side, like I think not being able to keep up with like telling our story at the same level of the product innovation that we have is really like, it's keeping me up at night, really. I'm struggling with this because I need to be in a mental space where I'm completely free for, let's say, a few days that I can really start thinking deep about this. I have some wireframes from the new version that I started in December. And like, I never quite found the time to make that better. And it's just so hard when you have something on the fire. And it's not something that I can do between two meetings here and there. I really need like to clear out, I don't know, a whole week or something. And with the kind of work structure that I have, so I'm still working as a product designer at a big company, plus doing this as a side project, there is really never this kind of time frame that I can spend on it. So it's okay, we're working on features and customer support and whatever at night, in the mornings when things are quiet, but a whole different new mind space for a big thing like this is really difficult. So I think now I need to either push through, or we probably need to like hire someone to do it for us. So the big fail, because yeah, my co-founder is like, dude, what's happening? It's 6 months now or more. I don't know, December, January, I don't even want to count anymore. So, yeah, that's something that I need to fix.
Yeah, all right. You'll push through. You always do. Anyway, all right. I think like the thing that you said about what you were doing with Fernand and Omar can kind of qualify as a hack, but I cannot let you go so easily. So we need the hack, Antoine. Maybe something smaller, you know, something productivity, AI, anything that other founders would appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, that was a good hack.
It was.
But yes, one thing that I do is I finally paid for ChatGPT Plus, and it lets you have like a lot of the cool image generation models. I think now it's kind of available on the free plans too, but don't know. And also
it's
has
just limited.
Great, yeah, maybe more limited and more memories for stuff. So I've created those projects on ChatGPT where I also, a bit similar to what we've done on Fernand, like added it some context. For example, I'm renovating a house right now, and I've uploaded like every document from the architect and everything. And then I just ask his question like, hey, how would you do blah, 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 blah. And it's so good. It's so good. I'm winning so much time. That's more personal. But like, for example, I have an agent that lets me write customer support help article things. So for example, when we release a new feature like this AI thing, I can just prompt it. It will give me the markdown article with all of the elements from our article system. I just have to copy and paste it, change a few things, add a screenshot, and boom, like a great article. And the nice thing with ChatGPT is you can also give it screenshots. So I just screenshot the feature, I write a little description, and like write me changelog or whatever for this. And boom, it's like 99% there. Really good. It's also learning from the way I like to write and stuff. So this is definitely a huge, huge unlock.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good one. Well, we'll talk later. I'll also share how I use Perplexity as a babysitter. You can appreciate that. So
I could use this. I could definitely use this.
Yeah. But we'll get back to it. But thanks so much for, you know, for the story and the cool hacks, and, you know, really looking forward to see what you're doing with Fernand. And yeah, hopefully we'll see each other. I mean, this year it wasn't at OMR, but maybe next year, our usual dinner.
Sure. Come back to Hamburg. You're always welcome.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.